welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. I have known Eric ever since we first met climbing Mount Everest. He up from one side, me up from the other. We met at the top at the exact same moment, shook hands, and then he tried to shove me off claiming that he got there first. I survived. Please welcome the man who is tops wherever he goes, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kate Gorka. Very encouraging to know that there are people like Kate Gorka and Sebastian Gorka out there. In a couple of minutes, we're talking to another encourager. His name is John Zamirak. Folks, welcome back. As I promised, I wanted to bring things down a little bit and bring on the mellowest man I know, John Zamirak. John, welcome.
Dude, how's it going?
Just kidding. I can't even fake that for more than 5 seconds.
You
the Big Lebowski thing, I can't.
That was like 0.4 seconds.
Yeah, that's how long I could do the Big Lebowski. After that, it's all Woody Allen and Annie Hall. Sorry.
John, have you never been mellow? Have you never tried?
Yes, but only after a hangover so bad that I probably, should have taken it as a sign that I had a problem.
What are those lyrics you live in, Olivia Newton-John? Have you never been mellow? Have you never tried to find the comfort from inside you?
That has happened. That's happened when I had morphine after surgery, but I don't like that. Actually, I'll get in a nice hot bath. And I start to feel really relaxed. And then that scares me. I feel like I'm dying. And I hop out of the tub. I can't do a hot bath.
Out of that tub before you die. So listen, I'd love to talk to you about sloughing off dead skin. But, there's a lot of people listening. They may be eating something. So here's what we're going to talk about. Whatever you want to talk about.
All right.
Have you written anything lately, John Zamirak?
My new book is finally available from Amazon.
And it involves- Whoa.
Yes.
Big news, my friend.
Yes. So
congratulations. I have read the book. I may even have written the foreword to the book. John, seriously, big deal. Congratulations to you.
The book is called No Second Amendment, No First. And it's beautiful. It's in hardcover. I should go grab a copy and hold it up. But it turned out really, really well. It's been a long time in the making. Basically, it sums up why gun rights and the right to defend yourself against criminals, and more importantly, to defend yourself against a tyrannical government, why that is a fundamental part of the Christian faith. It is indistinguishable, inextricable from the whole rest of the Christian view of the human person. If you don't believe people can defend themselves against criminals and tyrants, then you're not really a Christian because you don't really respect people. You think people should be victims? You think it's okay for people to be bullied and tyrannized and starved and locked into ghettos and sent to concentration camps? That's what you believe if you don't think they can fight back against tyrants. And if you want people to have the power to fight back against tyrants, then you want the population to have access to guns. So the Second Amendment.
I thought you were going to be way more mellow. You're talking about guns. What is that about, John? Why would you bring up that kind of violent thing on a program like this when we're dedicated to this? What are you thinking?
What I'm thinking is that I wish the Second Amendment could be somehow added to the Nicene Creed. Now, we Catholics have added to the Nicene Creed in the past, which you Greeks have complained about. To which we answered, hey, we got to the Pope. We can do whatever we want. Right. So I would like the next time, if we get a decent Pope, I would like to ask him to add just the Second Amendment to the text of the Nicene Creed.
Big John. Every morning at the mine, you could see him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John.
So, John Zamirak, in our last segment, you were talking about how you would like to effectively put the Second Amendment into the Nicene Creed. As usual, you're only half kidding, because what you say in your book, your new book, No Second Amendment, No First, is that being able to defend ourselves from tyranny is central to living out our Christian faith, because there are tyrants who want to take away our Christian faith, or who want to infiltrate the church with demonic doctrines. And part of the Second Amendment, the genius of our founders, is to give us the Second Amendment.
Right. And what I show in the book is our Second Amendment didn't just fall from space like an alien artifact, like a monolith that the monkeys dance around. Our Second Amendment is the fruit of centuries of doctrinal development in the West. It starts with St. Augustine's theory of just war, that Christians are not called to absolute nonviolence, that we are called to defend the good and sometimes to kill and maim in defense of the good. Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages asked, well, could that be applied to overthrowing a tyrant? Can you apply just war theory to civil war? Does a king who's wicked and abuses his subjects deserve to be overthrown? And he kind of tentatively went in that direction, but he didn't come down firmly. During the Reformation, two groups of people came up and debated and really asserted that subjects who are being persecuted by their kings can overthrow the kings. And those two groups were the Calvinists on the one hand and the Jesuits on the other. The Calvinists in France were being persecuted by the Catholic king. So they came up with theories about overthrowing wicked kings like this and replacing them. The Catholics in England were being persecuted by the Protestants. Jesuits based in England or associated with England or looking at the case of England, like Charles Borromeo, came up with the theory you can overthrow a tyrannical king. The one group of people who never believed that were the Lutherans, because they were comfortably in the middle of Germany with friendly kings, and they never came up with that idea of overthrowing tyrants.
By the way, excuse me, but that led to the problem that Bonhoeffer faced, is that the Lutheran Church had pushed Romans 13 and the thinking that, oh, government is basically good. What, we don't need to stand against government. They pushed it so much that by the time Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany, they were utterly unprepared to stand up against his tyranny. And guess what? They didn't.
Right. Exactly. Thank you. I pitched that one right down home plate and you knocked it out of the park. So it's the theory that you can overthrow the government, especially if it persecutes your religion. The Calvinists in France and the Jesuits in England, both dissident groups, came up with this. These two groups that hated each other, they came up with this theory of overthrowing tyrants. That got into the DNA of the English when they overthrew Charles I. And then they overthrew James II. When they threw out King James II, in part because he was Catholic, in part because he was good friends with Louis XIV, who was persecuting Protestants viciously in France, taking children away from their parents to be raised Catholic, driving them out, slaughtering them. It was horrible. He was good friends with James II. So the English Protestants were understandably uncomfortable that James II, good friend of their persecutor, was now king. They threw him out. They brought in William and Mary. As a condition of William and Mary, the two Protestants they brought in to be king and queen of England, as a condition of them taking the throne, they had to sign something called the English Bill of Rights. And in it, it said no Protestant could be denied the right to have a firearm. Now, that's interesting. That, you know, being half Irish, that kind of rankles with me at first. Like, oh, what do you mean? What do you mean all the pruddies can have the guns? But then I think if you look at it in context, who had been persecuted by the English crown for their religion? The Puritans, the same people who founded America, had been persecuted by Charles I, Charles II, and James II for being Puritans. So they wrote into their civil Bill of Rights, as a condition of getting the throne, you guarantee Protestants can have guns, because guns are basic to religious freedom. That is where the text of our Second Amendment comes from, directly from the concern for the protection of the liberty of churches from a tyrannical government. Our churches in colonial America were the places where militias would gather, where they would practice, they would do firearms, they would do training, they would hear sermons from the local Protestant minister about the patriotic duty to fight in behalf of your community against the Indians, against the Spanish, against the French. 100 years of that is what prepared the way for the American Revolution. When George III started to act in a way that they considered tyrannical, they had been hearing for 100 years in their churches where they gathered to do militia gun practice about the need to resist tyrants and overthrow tyrants. And that's where America comes from. And the Second Amendment was simply codification of that. James Madison set up all these elaborate mechanisms in the Constitution to prevent the rise of a tyranny. But he said, ultimately, if all those things fail, the separation of power, checks and balances, federalism, if all those things fail, he said, you will have a militia of 500,000 of the armed citizens who would overthrow any tyrant. And that was in the Federalist 46. That is the ultimate DNA of America. America's DNA is, if you tyrannize us, we will overthrow you. And that is why the Second Amendment is the most important part of the Constitution. It is the enforcement mechanism of all the rest of it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to the ever mellow John Zmirak. His new book is called No Second Amendment, No First. Please get a copy. No Second Amendment, No First. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking to the ever mellow John Zmirak. John, you wrote this book, No Second Amendment, No First. We did a Socrates in the Studio with you, which we posted. We've aired it on this program. I just want to ask you, you know, when I read your book, because I'm not conversant in the literature, I was wondering, why did you write this book? Was there not a book like this before? Because it seems so fundamental, so utterly fundamental. And yet it sounds like nobody had laid it out the way you did.
Nobody felt they had to. It's like all these books refuting transgenderism now. Nobody in 1970 thought it was necessary to write a book proving that men and women were real. It was taken for granted. Nobody thought it was necessary to write a book on why gun rights were so fundamental to the American identity because it was so obvious. Nobody thought to show how the Christian worldview demands resistance to tyranny because it was so obvious. My uncle went and fought at Normandy because that was obviously true. My father served under General Patton in Germany because it was obviously true to Americans that resistance to tyranny is a good thing. Our founding fathers wrote it into our national DNA, and it was successfully transmitted as sort of, it was in the culture. It was the water we swum in until the radical disruption of the 70s and 80s, where we have a left that rejects the American founding, that regards the American founding as repulsive. And that's why they're always talking about, well, you know, that George Washington owned slaves. You know, Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. To which you should respond, Muhammad owned slaves. Are you going to go close all the mosques? Are you going to say we shouldn't let Muslims into the country? Well, no, that's not the same thing. Yes, it is the same thing. If you're going to say that the fact that somebody committed a sin and was imperfect means we have to dismiss everything he says, go tell that to the Muslims. They won't. They'll shut up and they'll go away because they're cowards. Well, we need to face them down. Every time they talk about slavery and the American founding, they don't care about slavery. These people are not trying to stop slavery in Sudan and in Libya today. They're not trying to stop the Saudis from having slaves. They care about delegitimizing the American founding because it contains all these mechanisms to protect us against tyranny from the government. And the people who want to delegitimize the American founding and throw pain on George Washington, I want to emphasize, they do not care at all about Black people or Hispanics or poor people. They only care about power, and they hate the Constitution because it limits their power to take our guns, to take away our kids, to censor our speech, to take our guns, to make us into veal calves at a meat processing plant, just waiting for our turn on the conveyor belt.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what our friend Jason Jones talks about in his book, The Great Campaign, against the Great Reset. The Great Reset is about turning us into slaves, basically. And if you don't want to be turned into a slave, you want to pick up a copy of No Second Amendment, No First by John Zmirak, because we actually need to understand this now. As you said, John, now is the time for us to get this, because we've all kind of taken it for granted until suddenly, whoops, people are trying to tell us it's not Christian to have guns. Lay down your firearms, be enslaved. That's the Christian thing. No, not exactly.
If that were Christianity, I would persecute it myself energetically.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Federalist paper number 46. This was at the core of our founding. This is not something added on. This is as basic as it gets, but we've only had to really mention this, as you say, now, which is why you wrote your book. But I have to say, and I don't know if you can comment on this, it's a big deal to me that you wrote this book, John, that there isn't another book that lays it out the way you do.
Well, thank you. And it's funny, until I started working on this book, I had literally never held a gun. I'm from New York City, where guns are, only felons are allowed to have guns. And I used to joke that everyone in America should be allowed to have a gun except members of the Zmirak family, because we were such crazy hotheads that I thought we were not safe. There should be some carve out. But in fact, once I moved down here and started working this book, I got a gun and I got good. I started going to a gun range. I'm a pretty good shot now with an AR-15, and I got a Beretta pistol. Beretta is the brand I chose because Beretta is the company in Venice that made the cannons we used against the Muslims at Lepanto. So I wanted my weapon to be the same weapon that was used to fight the Muslim hordes at the Battle of Lepanto.
Another good reason to get a Beretta is Beretta was on, starring Robert Blake, right after Starsky and Hutch.
That's right.
I grew up watching Starsky and Hutch, followed by Beretta with the great Robert Blake.
And the great cockatiel that he had.
Cockatiel, very important, folks, that you get a Beretta. So, John, so now you're a gun nut. I know you've killed some villains. We can't talk about that on this program.
Never killed anyone. I have no desire to kill anyone. My beagle, Rain, kills rats in the backyard. That is as much killing as happens around this room. So.
Well, but it is important, seriously, you've written a book laying out the intellectual basis for why the Second Amendment is utterly crucial.
But you asked me why I wrote it, what moved me to write it. Being locked in our homes, having our churches shuttered, having vaccines that hadn't been tested that were developed using aborted babies forced into our arms by the government or by our employers under the pressure of the government, having our churches lie to us and say that this vaccine was a moral duty and that its roots in abortion had no moral significance. The insane tyranny of 2020, followed by the theft of the 2020 election, the fact that every legal avenue for appeal was closed down, that peaceful protesters on January 6th were killed by Capitol Police and imprisoned for up to a decade for non-crimes. We are in the middle right now of a comprehensive attempt at tyranny. The lawfare that is being aimed at people like John Eastman and Sidney Powell and Donald Trump and Mike Flynn, the abuse of power by our elites, their absolute contempt for ordinary people, the hatred for ordinary white people that we see among our elites, the hatred of Jews that we see among our elites, the mass importation of third world immigrants who don't have skills, don't have high school education. We don't need them. They're being brought in to replace us. All these things make this urgent.
We'll be right back with John Zmirak. Welcome back. We're talking to John Zmirak. John, you have a new book out called No Second Amendment, No First. But I want to shift over to the quote unquote hate speech bill. This is so sickening. Can you tell my audience why trying to outlaw anti-Semitic speech is utterly idiotic? It is so stupid. But you know what? You can't put it past these guys in Congress. Go ahead.
I got a piece at stream.org. talking about this bill in Congress, which tries to outlaw anti-Semitic speech. It's outlawing speech. That right there, that's the deal killer. It's like somebody serves you a bowl of rat soup, and you say, well, it's not got that much rat in it. Try to eat around the rat. There's a rat floating in the bowl. Well, don't eat the rat. No, I'm not going to eat it. It has rat in it. This outlaws speech, okay? It's got too much rat in it. In Europe, they passed bills like this to outlaw denying the Holocaust. Guess what those bills were used for? They were then extended to, well, you can't trivialize the Holocaust. Well, that sounds good. Well, I wouldn't want that. But do you know what it amounts to? In Germany, if you say that Stalin's massacres in Ukraine were like the Holocaust, you can go to prison. If you say abortion is like the Holocaust, you can go to prison. If you say that the COVID regulations locking people in their homes were similar to what the Nazis did locking people in their homes, you can go to prison. Comparing anything to Nazi Germany is now illegal in Germany. And so it's used against Christians and conservatives exclusively. Muslims who say they hate the Jews, who praise Hitler, are not prosecuted. In France,
we're dumb enough in Congress to jump on this.
Mike Johnson and most of the Republicans. We are not just the stupid party. We used to joke that the Democrats were the evil party, Republicans are the stupid party. We are now the brain dead party, and the Democrats are just harvesting our organs. That is how dumb we have become. Paul Gottfried, a Jewish scholar who is the editor of Chronicles magazine, and everyone listening to you should subscribe to Chronicles magazine, the first magazine ever to publish me back in 1992. He writes, these speech bans are 100% a tactic for silencing conservatives and Christians. And right now in Canada, there are pastors trying to stay out of prison for preaching Leviticus's doctrine on homosexuality. And Canada is about to pass a hate speech bill, which allows people to be imprisoned without trial and held under house arrest without trial on suspicion that they might commit hate speech. That is what the left wants. They want tyranny.
Anybody believe this, that in America, that people don't understand? This is why we have to understand these things, folks. The idea, you say, well, that's wrong. Let's outlaw it. No, 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 no. When you want to be free, you allow things that are wrong sometimes to be legal. Doesn't make them right. But if you make them illegal, now the government gets involved. And now the government is involved in what you can say and think. This is not freedom. But the idea that we have Republicans stupid enough, shame on them.
Do you want people like Fannie Willis prosecuting what they consider hate crimes with judges like Judge Chutkin and like OJ juries deciding who's guilty? That's what you're opening the door for. A comprehensive tyranny right here in America.
Are you saying OJ didn't kill anybody? Is that what you're saying, John Smirak?
They killed John F. Kennedy.
That was good. That was good. I think I'd like to end on that note. Folks, please get a copy of No Second Amendment, No First by John Smirak. Starts with a Z-M-I-R-A-K. Don't forget, we're doing a campaign. There is real slavery in Sudan. You can do something about it. If you care about Black people being enslaved today, go to metaxastalk.com. You'll see the banner. Please click on the banner. Please do anything you can. Metaxastalk.com. Thank you.
The biggest stories in the world is happening right now, and we haven't heard a peep out of the controlled media. That's to be expected, but you'd think that something that could change the trajectory of the entire world in relation to health would be something that they're interested in. Well, the reason they're not is because the establishment does not want you to know that 49 senators in the United States are brave enough to tell the World Health Organization and the world that the WHO is not and cannot be trusted. Now, for those who've been paying attention, we've been raising the issues surrounding the international health regulations and the proposed pandemic treaty for months. The original proposed amendments to the IHR included erasing human rights, dignity, and fundamental freedoms from all future pandemic responses, essentially giving them full immunity to do what they told Dr. Tess Laurie they wanted to do inside a closed World Health Assembly meeting in February of 2022. Their words, and I quote by her recollection, was that next time they wanted to force vaccinate and punish anyone who did not comply with injection mandates. Well, since that meeting, more and more people have been demanding their countries exit the World Health Organization and the UN as a whole because of all of the details that have emerged surrounding their evil plans for humanity. The WHO has since edited their proposed amendments to re-include your dignity and human rights, but that's not the point. Their initial intention was to never treat you like a free human again. What makes us think that intention is now gone? Well, this week, 49 US senators dropped a bombshell on the World Health Organization. The tide is turning. In a shocking turn of events, all Republican senators, 49, led by Senator Ron Johnson, have formally urged President Joe Biden to withdraw his support in expanding the World Health Organization's pandemic authority. The letter, sent ahead of the 77th World Health Assembly, scheduled from May 27th to June 1st, 2024, in Geneva, Switzerland, argues that the WHO's mishandling of the COVID-19 crisis underscores the need for major reforms rather than granting it more power. The senators warned that such an expansion could threaten US sovereignty and constitutional rights, emphasizing that any international agreement enhancing WHO's authority should be treated as a treaty requiring a two-thirds supermajority vote in the Senate for approval. "This is big news," wrote Dr. Meryl Nass on X. 49 senators, every Republican senator, have told President Biden to withdraw US support for the treaty and the IHR amendments. But if the US does go forward, the treaty or treaties will have to be submitted to the Senate for its advice and consent, requiring a two-third vote, which is an appropriate threat. The official letter states, "Dear Mr. President, next month, during the 77th World Health Assembly, your administration is expected to commit the United States to two international agreements that would strengthen the WHO's authority to declare public health emergencies of international concern and expand the WHO's authority over member states during such emergencies. This is unacceptable. The WHO's failure during the COVID-19 pandemic was total as it was predictable and did lasting harm to our country. The United States cannot afford to ignore this latest WHO inability to perform its most basic function and must insist on comprehensive WHO reforms before even considering amendments to the IHR or any new pandemic-related treaty that would increase WHO authority. We are deeply concerned that your administration continues to support these initiatives and strongly urge you to change course. Article 55 of the IHR requires the text of any IHR amendment to be communicated to member states at least 4 months before the WHA at which they are to be considered. As the WHO has still not provided final amendments text to member states, and I'll just divert here and say that was due in January and they missed that deadline. Therefore, any further negotiations are in fact a violation of their own international law under Article 55. It says, we submit that the IHR amendments may not be considered at next month's WHA. Some of over the 300 proposals for amendments made by member states would substantially increase the WHO's health emergency powers and constitute intolerable infringements upon US sovereignty. As such, it was essential that the WHO abide by the four-month notice period to allow member states time to ensure that no traces of such proposals were included in a final amendment package for consideration by the WHA. Having failed to do so, amendments are not in order. And I'll add again there, the WHO proceeding with this are actually in violation of their own constitution under Article 55. The letter continues, the WHO's most recent publicly available draft of its new pandemic response treaty is dead on arrival. Instead of addressing the WHO's well-documented shortcomings, the treaty focuses on mandated resource and technology transfers, shredding intellectual property rights, infringing free speech, and supercharging the WHO. Moving forward with a new pandemic preparedness and response treaty ignores the fact that we are still unsure of the COVID-19's origins because Beijing continues to block a legitimate independent investigation. We strongly urge you to not to join any pandemic-related treaty, covenant, or agreement being considered at the 77th WHA. Should you ignore this advice, we state in the strongest possible terms that we consider any such agreement to be a treaty requiring the concurrence of two-thirds of the Senate under Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution. In light of the high stakes for our country and our constitutional duty, we call upon you to 1. Withdraw your administration's support for the current IHR amendments and pandemic treaty negotiations. 2. Shift your administration's focus to comprehensive WHO reforms that address its persistent failures without expanding its authority. And 3. Should you ignore these calls, submit any pandemic-related agreement to the Senate for its advice and consent. Sincerely, Ron Johnson, undersigned Rick Scott also. And you can see that letter there. And you can also click there to read the letter as a PDF file. We encourage you to download it, share it everywhere. Even Senators Mitt Romney and Mitch McConnell signed that letter. Now, some would say it's not far enough, and that is my personal opinion. The United Nations Agenda 2030 and by extension 2045 plans are, in the simplest terms, anti-human. They and many of their subsidiaries have clearly articulated their goals of transitioning humans to some sort of cyborg species that is linked to AI and the Internet of Everything with internal body sensors and gene modification technology, largely delivered through pharmaceutical products and food. And that includes injections, by the way, whether the large ones or their microneedle patches. Of course, most people would oppose being cyborgized, therefore giving the WHO any power at all allows them to mandate it. Anyone who understands just how insane this body of transhumanist organizations serving the UN is would agree that they are in fact a threat to humanity and our very existence, not to mention a threat to national sovereignty. The UN has goals of creating a one-world government, AI-run government, which they call the AI World Society. Every aspect of Agenda 2030 is in order to reach this goal. That means every single government official should be concerned that their jobs in future will be made obsolete and replaced by AI at the behest of the UN. If you don't believe me, I'll direct you to this X post that I reposted from a Z Media investigation in March of 2023, where the official fundraising platform of Ukraine, Ukraine 24, admits that the nation is being rebuilt to be fully digital, no cash, no government, AI judiciary, AI everything. This is the exact vision described by the UN 100 group in their book, Remaking the World Towards an Age of Global Enlightenment, which we've also covered in this broadcast previously. We can also look to the comments of the World Economic Forum's Yuval Noah Harari, who has said openly that in 2024, it will be the last election involving humans and in future, leaders would be decided by AI. Maybe leaders would be AI. So, in my humble opinion, no, the letter does not go far enough. What if we end up with three quarters of the Senate completely in agreement with what the WHO wants, even though the people don't want it? We see examples of senators around the world making all sorts of decisions and ignoring the people who oppose them. What if, simultaneously, they put a woke AI program to go along with the WHO's goals for transhumanism through largely lethal injections at the helm of the Senate? Considering billions of your tax dollars are flowing to Ukraine to do exactly that, I'd say it isn't too much of a stretch. Apart from this, if the WHO is already operating in violation of Article 55 of their own international binding laws, what makes us think that they'll even play by the rules if restrictions are put on them anyway? Nonetheless, this is a vitally important milestone from US senators to show that they're not playing ball, and a very good sign that representatives are pushing back on this evil institution that pretends that it cares about health. Now we need to see it go further, people need to be informed on just how far the UN and WHO want to take their transhumanism goals. And the ultimate outcome should be an exit from the UN and WHO and a dismantling of these enemy of humanity organizations.
The value of gold is going to be broadly unchanged. But what will happen is the value of credit will collapse.
Mm.
And that obviously gets reflected in, purchasing, sort of rate, say, between dollars or euros and gold or whatever, which makes you think that gold's gone up. I mean, it's not gold going up. Now, eventually that will happen. That is what happens when the value of credit collapses. Forget what the price is in paper marks or paper dollars or whatever it might be. You know, the gold price, you'll find that at that stage, the purchasing power of gold will absolutely rocket.
Fiat currency, like the U.S. dollar and other government-issued currencies, presents significant challenges to wealth preservation. Over time, one of the most concerning issues with fiat currency is its diminishing purchasing power. Visual Capitalist data reveals that since 1971, the U.S. dollar has lost 98% of its purchasing power. The U.S. dollar has recently been a prominent topic, with growing discussions about reducing its role in international trade. In contrast, the price of gold has faced some fluctuations, with a 5% drop in a week and a nearly 4% decline in a month. Despite this short-term volatility, Alistair MacLeod believes that gold's intrinsic value will likely remain relatively stable. However, he underscores a crucial point. The value of credit, represented by currencies such as the dollar and euro, is expected to collapse. This devaluation of credit will create the illusion of rising gold prices, while in reality, the declining purchasing power of these currencies drives this perception. Consequently, even with relatively high interest rates, the situation is expected to persist, posing substantial challenges for businesses that have heavily leveraged themselves during the era of near zero or negative interest rates, especially in the European Union. Central banks are likely to face significant difficulties in responding to this situation. They have amassed negative equity because of their involvement in the bond market through quantitative easing, QE. Given their precarious financial positions, as bond prices decline and non-performing loans increase, central banks have limited options to rescue the financial system. To address these issues, central banks may resort to massive credit expansion. This move could have dire consequences for ordinary people, including pensioners and those dependent on state support, as their purchasing power erodes. MacLeod foresees potentially devastating outcomes, particularly for vulnerable groups like pensioners and ordinary individuals who rely on state support for their financial well-being. We will now bring you clips from Alistair MacLeod's interview with Kinesis Money, but before we do, if you want more videos like this, hit the subscribe button and turn on the notification bell for more updates. Thank you and enjoy the video.
An awful lot of people who are gold bugs in our camp are looking at it completely the wrong way. They think that it's an investment, which they buy it, if they're lucky at 1800 and they sell at 2000 or something like that. It's not an investment, it's money. And it's the superior form of money to credit. So you acquire it as a hedge against the collapse of the purchasing power of credit. So, what the price is going to be, say, in a year or 2 years' time, I would assume that the value of gold is going to be broadly unchanged. When the value of credit collapses, forget what the price is in paper marks or paper dollars or whatever it might be. The gold price, you'll find that at that stage, the purchasing power of gold will absolutely rocket. But that's not what we're talking about at the moment. All we're talking about is the purchasing power of unattached credit sinking. And it's going to sink at such rates that not only are high interest rates, I mean, these are not high interest rates anyway. These levels are going to persist and the interest rates are going to go even higher. And if you think about that, the effect on businesses which have over-leveraged themselves debt-wise at zero interest rates, negative interest rates in the European Union, you can see that there is a lot of pain to come. And how are the authorities going to respond to that? Well, let's look at the central banks. They're all in negative equity. Why? Because they ramped up the bond market and then bought bonds right at the top. It's called QE. And now they're deeply underwater and not admitting it. How are they going to rescue banks whose balance sheets come under pressure from falling bond prices in particular, and also non-performing loans? I mean, particularly from the the wider economy, because 80% of the economy is small and medium-sized businesses, not the the big stuff that always fills the newspaper headlines. I mean, how are they going to do this? I mean, to try and rescue the entire system when the system itself is in negative equity, basically means that you're going to get a massive expansion of the quantity of senior credit. And it is credit. This is what the central banks issue in the form of notes and also obligations in the form of reserves and whatever to commercial banks. That is a senior form of credit. It's not money. It is credit. And amazingly, I mean, I have so many economists who tell me that no. What the central bank issues and base money is money. It's replaced gold. Oh, come on. They don't understand it. They really don't. There's a very nasty lesson for us all, I'm afraid. I don't welcome this at all, Andy. I think this is going to be terrible. I mean, the poor, and by this I also mean pensioners and all the rest of it, ordinary people who have relied on the state to provide them with pensions and so on and so forth. I mean, they're going to get wiped out. This is not good. This really is not good.
China's central bank extended its gold buying spree to the 10th straight month as the world's second largest economy seeks to move away from its reliance on dollar reserves. According to Bloomberg, the People's Bank of China's stockpile of the precious metal climbed by 29 tons in August to 2,165 tons. A total of about 217 tons were added over the last 10 months, the outlet said. Gold prices in China have soared, hitting a historic relative high with a more than 100 premium dollars per ounce over metal prices in New York or London, according to Bloomberg. According to McLeod, the Chinese have accumulated a substantial amount of gold, estimated at around 21,000 tons, through deliveries from the Shanghai Gold Exchange alone. Additionally, it is suggested that an additional 25,000 to 30,000 tons may be held by the state, along with a further 20,000 tons in the hands of the public. This considerable stockpile of gold positions China well in anticipation of any potential collapse of Western fiat currencies. McLeod notes that the Chinese government seems cautious about triggering such a collapse and is content to let Western currencies face their challenges while preserving their advantageous position regarding gold. Let's get back to the interview.
Independently of Roman law, which set out things that, gold is money and the rest is credit, and all us Westerners have it as the basis of our common law. It doesn't matter what our governments have said subsequently. That is fact. The Chinese already got there by, different routes, if you like. They realize that it is money. Now, after the death of Mao in 1983, legislation was produced which appointed the People's Bank of China as the sole responsibility of acquiring and managing the state's gold reserves. Okay, so that was 1983. They started accumulating gold at a time when there was a massive bear market in gold, which took it down from, 1983, I think it was about $400 or $500, something like that, down to 250 or something in 2022. Coincidentally, in 2022, they'd obviously decided that they'd got enough gold. Now, I should also add that they increased their mine output, deliberately invested in mine output. Yeah. So they became the largest miner in the world by a country mile. They also ensured they continued to have a monopoly over refining, and they were even importing gold from elsewhere or Doré or whatever and refining it. And did it ever leave? Did it? Hell is like. No, it stayed there. So that was interesting. Now, they obviously decided that they'd acquired enough gold by 2022 to allow people to begin to acquire gold. And that was why the Shanghai Gold Exchange was set up again under the control of the People's Bank. It's 100% owned by the People's Bank. So since then, as you rightly pointed out, they've you know, they've even had television adverts, buy gold, whatever, whatever, whatever. And you know, the Chinese people haven't needed a lot of persuading. It's come out of the vaults. What we look at is the Shanghai Gold Exchange deliveries out of the vaults. It's really come out into two markets. I mean, there's a bar market, and at the same time, you've obviously got the jewelry market. So if you talk to the World Gold Council, they're really concentrating on the jewelry side. But since then, the people have accumulated, I think if you tot it up, something like 21,000 tons of gold on the basis of these deliveries. I mean, it is fascinating. The result is that they've probably got, I don't know, somewhere between 25 and 30,000 tons. And that's the state, on top of which there's a further sort of, 20 odd thousand tons in the hands of the public. This is a very, very big slice of above ground stocks. And so they are well protected against the time when Western fiat currencies actually, meet their Armageddon. The Chinese are already there. It's just they don't want to trigger it. The Russians are a lot more aggressive. But as far as the Chinese are concerned, no, we will let the West make mistakes. We will let Western currencies, sink. We will let all that happen. We are not going to aggravate this situation.
As the purchasing power of fiat currencies continues to erode amid escalating inflation, investors and central banks will increasingly turn to gold as a crucial component of their currency holdings. How do you see the future of fiat currencies and gold as stores of value? Share your thoughts in the comments section below. Also, ensure you like this video, subscribe to the channel, and turn on post notifications for more videos like this. Thanks for watching.